It is October 28th, 2011. I'm talking to Dick Groski in his place of residence. I am Joseph Morris, representing the Linda McKnight Batman Oral History Project for the Historical Society of Central Florida. Sir, could you tell us a little about yourself? What? Could you tell us a little about yourself and your life?
Well, what would you like?
Where were you born, sir? Where were you raised?
Springfield, Ohio.
And when did you come down to Florida, sir?
Well, right after I got married in the early 40s, I got out of the service in 46, and we got married the same year, and we came to Florida in the real early 50s.
Okay, sir, and did you move originally to?
No, we were going to Miami, and I blew out a tire. It was over on US 1, and we blew a tire out on the car, and it was late at night on Sunday. We stopped in a motel over on US 1. The next morning, we got up, and I asked where the local garage was, and they said, oh, it's clear over in Bithlow, over Dave Shaw's garage. So there happened to be a fellow there that was going that way, and so he took my tire, and we threw it in the back of his truck, and he took me over to Dave Shaw's garage, which is right in the middle of no place. Well, Dave got the tire fixed, one thing or another, and in the meantime, while he was fixing the tire, I said, well, look at the local newspaper. So I'm just thumbing through it. There's an ad in there, machinist wanted. So I asked Dave Shaw, I said, well, where is this? Well, he said, that's over in Orlando, which is short race in Bithlow. So I put a dime in the telephone, it was a dime at that time, and I called this man up, and he was from Youngstown, Ohio. And I told him, I said, well, I said, I've been a toolmaker all my life, and he said, I got a job for you. He says, come on over. So I said, well, I wait till I get my tire fixed, and I'll come over. So he gave me the directions, and I come over to Orlando, and I went down on Sly Boulevard, and Tool Engraving. Sly, it was Trade Tool Engraving was the name of the place. And he said, I'll let you run a screw machine, second shift. I said, great. Warren Swayze, I'd run one before. So I went back to Titusville, told the missus, I said, well, we're going to have to stay here tonight. But I said, tomorrow we're going to Orlando. And she said, well, what's the matter with you going to Miami? I said, I got a job. She said, you got a job? I said, yeah, I go to work tomorrow night. And I've never been out of work since.
Wow, sir. So why were you going to Miami?
I don't know. I just thought that was a place where it was warm and there was a lot of something going on.
We got distracted by Orlando?
And well, we got stuck here and been here ever since.
And then how long did you work at the...
The trade tool?
Yes, sir.
Only, the best part of a year, and that's when the Martin Company came here. And I helped build the Martin plant, and then I went to work in industrial engineering. And I stayed out there about a year and a half, I guess, and then I started my own thing and been going ever since.
Okay, and how did you start your own business, sir?
One tool at a time.
And how long have you been in business?
Oh, my gosh. I've always had a shop. We moved the shop down when I moved down from Ohio.
Oh, really, sir?
Yeah.
So you were doing this up in Ohio as well?
Yeah. I had a shop in Brookville, Ohio, and then we left Brookville to come to Florida. And I had our furniture and the shop on a semi. We was going to move it down here. And we moved to after we had the blowout over in Titusville, and I got a job there, we went over here on 1792 and rented a three-room apartment over there. And I had all the shop equipment come down then after we got established, and I rented a place over in Alamont Springs. It was about a four-story... a four-office little building at Maris Wofford. He owned the whole town practically. He built this building just as a little commercial building, and I rented one of the offices in there. We put all the machinery in there. And at that time, I was working at the Martin Company, so we got our little shop going, so I quit the Martin Company, went back out there, went to purchasing, and I said, I'd like to bid on your work. And it's been going ever since.
Okay, sir. And... Could you tell me a little about the place where you grew up? I know it was in Ohio, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Have you been back?
Only when my dad died in 1966. I haven't been back since.
Okay, sir. What was it like growing up out there?
It was right prior to World War II, and things were tight, but it was a lot easier, better times than what it is now. It wasn't near as fast-paced. People had more of value than they do now. Smaller things meant more. We lived in a middle-class neighborhood where everybody worked, and everybody went to school, everybody had a car, And we played croquet at night in the backyard. We played football down at the local park. We played baseball at the local park and pitched horseshoes. There was always something to do. The local park was just a matter of trees, a drinking fountain, and a shelter house. But there the city provided ball gloves and tennis rackets and things, so you could go in there, sign your name, and get a ball glove and go play ball.
Okay.
And that was kind of the center of activity of the whole community. We lived in what they call Walnut Hills. And it was a very clannish type situation because at that time in that area, the National Cash Register, General Motors, Frigidaire, Dayton Rubber, and those bigger companies, a job was something that there was nothing to be concerned about. That was something that your dad and your dad's dad probably worked at these same companies over the last three or four generations because that's the way things were. You didn't have to hunt for a job. Shop like I got now, a job shop, there was hundreds of them in that town. You pick up the phone call and say, hey, what do you got going? You got 30 days worth of work? I'll be over this afternoon. He had another job. That's job shopping. But if you wanted to go to the major companies like Dayton Rubber or Frigidaire or one of the big ones, Master Electric, where they made motors, you can go in there higher on. They expected you and your kids' kids to work there. It was job security, which you have none today. Today, it's feast or famine. If we got a job today and you finish it up 2 o'clock, goodbye. Go home. There is no security in jobs today, unless you create your own security.
Right, sir.
There is nothing. You can't depend on the other man for anything.
Okay, sir. And how... So you left... You just wanted a change of scenery and you came down to Miami for that reason? Or you were on your way to Miami for that reason?
No, I spent, like I said, I spent a lot of time over in China and Burma and India.
Right, sir.
And it was all hot weather, very hot. We came home in February. And it was just kind of the tail end of the winter, but there was a lot of snow and ice on the ground. And after being in the tropics for that long and coming into snow and ice on the ground, and I got married, I told her we got married. I said, look, I said, we're going someplace else. And I said, I'm not going to shovel snow. I said, I'm not used to this. My later teens and then early 20s, I was overseas, and I said, boy, I'm not going home and shoveling any snow. So we told her parents, we told my parents, and my dad says, if you take her and them kids out of high, I'll disown you, which he did. We never got one dime for him, and he was a wealthy man when he died. I got just exactly nothing because I took her and came to Florida with the kids.
And that was... Your dad or her dad?
No, that was my dad. Now, her dad was more lean. He was from Georgia. He was a farmer from Georgia. He had a pretty nice business going. And he said, well, he said, I can understand why you're doing what you're doing. And he says, if we can help you, we will. But my dad was from the old school, and if it ain't his way, it's no way. It was that bit. He said, you don't know what you're doing. He said, you're leaving all the security and this and that and everything else. And I said, no, I'm not. I said, now, I was in the service, I've been clear around the world. I said, I've seen other places, I've been other places and done other things. I'm not going to sit here and shovel snow. I'm going someplace else. Well, if you do, you're disowned. And he did.
What did your dad do for a living? Did he work in one of these?
He was vice president of the Typographical Union.
Okay, sir. I can definitely see why, after going to the tropics, that Miami might have come to mind.
That was the only... Orlando, it was just a wide spot in the road. Like Kissimmee, that was just a few cars walking up and down the road. But Orlando did have a name, but it didn't have a name like Jacksonville or Miami. Now, my wife's from Georgia, and some of her relation, her dad or her uncle, was warden of the Duval County Farm up there. So we came down, prior to moving, we came down here and visited. And we talked to her uncle at great length, and he was a very, very, very knowledgeable man and knew... basics of life right here in Florida. So I asked him a lot of pointed questions. He gave me the answers. He said, it's going to be up to you. He said, there are opportunities here. It's up to you to make them. He said, you can go out there and hustle around. He said, you'll make them. He said, Florida's growing. He was born and raised there. I figured, boy, you know what you're talking about. So that changed our opinion on going to Miami. After talking to people who had been there and back and one thing another, salesmen and people that went down there to live and got out of the little Havana area or whatever, they said, stay up in Orlando area. Been here ever since.
Okay, so after you moved here, you were still thinking about going down to Miami afterwards?
No.
Just talking to these people?
No, that was it. That canceled that out. I only was to Miami one time, since we moved to Florida, and we had a subcontract on the FAA building in Miami, and we supplied a lot of the high-pressure ductwork down there. We built it. And we had to go down, as owner of the shop, we had to go down to physically see that our work was in that job, it was a government job, our work was in that building and that contract and blah, 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 blah. And I had to go down there about three different times. But other than that, I never went back.
Okay, sir.
That's where Miami and me ended.
That's where you and Miami have just parted ways.
Yep.
Okay, sir. Well, how has Orlando changed from when you moved here to now?
They have ruined Orlando.
Really, sir?
Yeah.
In what way?
Due to the fact that the people that were responsible, once Orlando was established as a town, and the multitude started moving into that town, the way Orlando was originally set up was a farm town that was easygoing or whatever. As soon as it started to grow with a vast amount of people, which happened in the 50s, it really blossomed. And when it did, they lost reality with what Orlando was all about. When we moved here, you could drink the water out of Prairie Lake. You could go along, there was water along the ditches on every main road out of the main area of the town here. There was fish in these ditches. People would be along the side of Route 50 fishing, and water wasn't that deep, but there were fish in them. I worked at the Martin Company, and when I'd come home at night, I'd take the boys, and we'd go over to Lake Monroe and sit there on the seawall, and in an hour's time, I'd have a bucket so full of fish you couldn't hardly pick it up. Where'd they all go? Where'd the mullet go? Where'd the blue crabs go? Everything has been polluted. They've ruined Central Florida. Now we've got crime, a lot more. A shooting in Central Florida back in the 50s was unheard of, unless it was a hunting accident, somebody pulled a gun out and shot his own foot. It was unheard of. Now it's an everyday occurrence. You go to Pine Hills today and somebody's going to shoot somebody before you can drive through it. They have ruined Central Florida because that is the element that follows growth. There's that type of personnel will follow growth and try to reap what they can off of it. And they have ruined Central Florida. Central Florida. I won't even go to the coast. You used to be able to go any place up and down the East Coast. You could pull off the side of the road, cross the dunes, and go fishing. It's all barricaded off. Chain link fence. Keep out. Don't come here. Don't go there. When we first moved, when we first got our shop established in Alamont Springs, I went to council meeting and several of the management meetings downtown or city of Orlando. And most of the people down there, a lot of the people down there were from Baltimore. Baltimore entered big in Central Florida because the Martin came here. Martin Company came here, they brought all their people with them. And come to find out, most of the people that came with the Martin Company from Baltimore were the offfalls they wanted to get rid of anyway. And that's how the Martin Company started here. Well, I helped build the building, then I went to work in it. And I know them firsthand. But at any rate, I had a shop in Alamont Springs. I had the first screw machine in Seminole County. So I went to one of these meetings down there, and I got a chance to speak my voice. I got up and I said, well, you fellas don't have any manufacturing base here. I said, you got high acre juice plant. I said, you've got two or three big packing houses, one Blue Goose, and I said, you've got another packing house over Maitland. But I said, you don't have anything that's making anything. You don't produce anything. You don't have any sawmills. You don't have any manufacturing, no welding shops, no nothing. Why? Because we're tourist-oriented. That's a famous saying. We're tourist-oriented. And still to this day, they're still leaning away from manufacturing. They don't want any manufacturing in Central Florida. I tried to explain to them how the economy in Cincinnati and Dayton was based on all of these little job shops that was doing something. Now what if you got blacks running up and down the ladder picking oranges? That ain't going to help the economy, not one nickel's worth. The Grove owner's going to make money, but you and I aren't. I said, you have to have diversified activity in that community. And you know, they said, well, you probably got a pretty good idea, but we don't want to hear no more. And that's where they shut it off. And I said, well, to hell with you, goodbye. And it's still today the same situation. They want tourists, get them in, fleece them, send them on a plane back home. They don't want nothing here permanently. Go downtown. What have they done for the people who live here? If you go someplace, you're going to pay mighty dear for it because you're going to pay just like a tourist. They don't give the local people any. They don't say, hey, show me your driver's license. You can come in for $2. Hey, it's $28. We might charge you $30 because you live here. I'm soured on it, believe me. That's why we're out here on our own little domain. I have nothing to do with them.
Okay, sir. So, it's kind of like maybe a little bit of a weird question then. So you're not a, you don't go to, never, or have you ever gone to any of the theme parks that attract the tourists?
I've done work for Disney World and Universal and everybody else, but it's always on a bid item basis. The only reason I will go there is to take a job out, give them a purchase order, and hope I get paid. That's the only way. As far as spending my money to go to their park, I wouldn't spend a dime.
No, they are expensive, sir.
I wouldn't spend a dime.
When you say hope you get paid, have you ever had a problem with receiving payment from these
Martin
companies?
Company and Disney start out the same way. 30 days on invoice, 60 days on invoice, 90 days on invoice. Martin Company got 120 days on invoice. I took the last invoices right down to personnel and right into payroll. I said, I want to get paid for these. Well, we're a big company, you know, it takes time. I said, no, you're not that big. I said, I'm a little guy. We started out 30-day invoice. Okay, 60, I can live with. 90, I'm hurting. 120, I can't do it. Any more work we do from you, COD. Now, I'm a little guy talking to a big guy. And I said, that's it. They needed us at that time more than we needed them because there was nobody else except Mark Heavening and I that had a shot.
Okay, so they kept trying to put you off.
That's right. They kept stringing us out. Well, we're a big company. I said, yes, you ought to be able to do it twice as fast because you have more facilities than we do. You ought to be able to make your pay the same day.
Right, sir.
So I said, COD.
So your business work with these companies have not been all you wish they could be?
Well, the Martin Company, as you know right now, is one of the largest defense contractors there is in the United States. And had we, at that time, had we had somebody on our side that could go internally there, today we'd probably be a multi-million dollar corporation because they made some big companies out of what happened at Martin Company throughout the United States.
Okay, but because you couldn't get anybody, or you didn't have anybody to
work
with you there.
We was an outsider. We had nobody on the inside.
Gotcha, sir.
Now, when the shuttle's arm came up at the Cape, the robotic arm, we were doing NASA work at the time. So I went out to procurement, and I said to him, I said, well, we'd like to bid on this robotic arm. And he says, okay, fine. He said, you're qualified, you're DOD, and checked out and everything, fine. We got a set of drawings, we come back, and we figured it out. We could make the complete thing except the one base had a milled slot about 12, 14 feet long. We couldn't mill it. I had a friend in Winter Haven that had a big Niles planer. He could do it. We submitted our bid. We were second, number two. Now, for a little shop, and that was a big job. There was only, I think, four of them to start with, and they were over a period of 2 or 3 years. The man out in Iowa got the job. We went out and protested. He don't have enough money in his bid to buy the material to do the job. The purchase agent out there on that contract was a woman. She said, well, Mr. Grosky, she said, I'll tell you. She said, we can't control where he gets his material from. He may have a warehouse full. That's the only out I got. He may have a warehouse full. We had to buy it. He had a warehouse. I said, okay. Less than 30 days, they came back and said, we want you to pick up the contract. He went bankrupt. I says, goodbye. That's what I told NASA.
We wouldn't touch it. But you worked with NASA afterwards, right?
Yeah.
Just not on that contract?
Not on that. Nope. We dropped that right by the wayside. They wanted us to come back and pick up the ball and clean up the mess and sweep the dirt. I said, no dice. We don't get it going in you. We don't want any part of it.
Okay, so can you tell me more about the work you've done with NASA? Because that does a lot for the local community, the local area.
No, the only thing that we got out there was small stuff that they couldn't buy or procure. Onesie-twosie things that, like, certain types of bearings and special screws and just little nitpicking stuff. Nothing big.
Okay, sir.
Nothing big. No big contracts, nothing. Biggest contract we had was from the Navy over here at the training center. And we did Navy work, but There's too much red tape in all of that work. I'd rather have work off the street. The last Navy job we had, they made 4 change orders on it. It was for a nuclear submarine. And there was 4 change orders, and after the second or third change order, the fourth change order went right back to the first change order, and that we'd already scrapped it, and we had to do it all over again. They don't know what they're doing.
Gotcha, sir. So,
we're very, very, very selective if we take work out that we don't know the people that we're going to do it for. I would rather do 100% commercial work. 100%. But right now, the customers we've got all the good customers in Central Florida that they bring work to us. If we take something out to one of those customers and it's not according to what maybe they think they want or they really need, they've already given us okay to do it or a purchase order behind it. We make it, we fab it, we take it out, and if it's not exactly what they want, it goes right in the dumpster and we get paid for it because that's the way we do business. This is what you wanted and this is what you got. Now, if you can't use it, that ain't my problem. You got what you ordered. And that's the way we do business.
Gotcha, sir. Okay. Could you tell me a little more about the business here, then? I know we discussed earlier, but could you tell me more about what kind of work you do and for who you do it for?
Well, we do sheet metal work, welding, and machine work, general machine work for the complete population. No matter what industry or what kind of a business they have going, we've made everything you can possibly think of. We've made parts for outboard motors, typewriters, telephones, fishing equipment, hunting equipment, dies, jigs, drill jigs, fixtures, screw machine parts, you name it. If it's made out of metal, we've made it. We make high-pressure ductwork, sheet metal ductwork. We make low-pressure ductwork. We make all kind of turning vanes, fittings, the whole gamut. Whatever there is in small metalwork, we do.
Okay, sir. And can you tell me how...
We might have been stymied, I think, once or twice, and that was when we had something that was a... It was more of a compound angle that we didn't have facilities to do it with, but I have a friend out in Apopka that's got a water jet machine. We took it out there to him, and he water jetted it, and we went merrily on our way. So we have an out. We take them all.
Gotcha, sir. Okay. Can you tell me how your business has changed over the years or grown?
The business, we try to, according to the tax structure, the way it's set up, we're allowed a tax deduction to amortize a piece of machinery over a 5-year period. Now I understand Obama has allowed small businesses to amortize that machine in 1 year. Now like when we bought our big boring mill down there, that's a $12,000 machine. We could take a tax write-off in 5 years for that machine for the $12,000. Well, if you happen to have a good year, that $12,000 would mean a lot if you could deduct it, but you can't deduct it except for in a 5-year period. So you wind up paying more taxes for spending more money, and that's not right. If you're spending more money, you should be able to deduct it. Okay. If it's shop equipment, it's capital equipment. But now, I think they got it set up now to where you can deduct that in 1 year or 2 year period, rather than a 5-year period.
And you said amortize, right?
Yeah.
What does that mean, sir?
The government would only allow you to deduct off of your tax. Say I bought something for $1,000, a piece of machinery for $1,000. Every year, I could get a $200 reduction on that piece of machinery. Tax write-off on that machinery. And at the end of 5 years, I had a tax write-off of that $1,000. Then that machine could no longer be amortized anymore. That machine was a dead piece of equipment in that business. It was part of the business. It made the business worth that much more. But as far as taxes go, you're done. There's no more relief on taxes for it.
Okay. So, well, I know we talked about this a little bit earlier. How is business doing these days?
Very bad. Our little shop down there was doing great up until about 2002, and I could see then it was starting to slide. Because we'd have customers the whole gamut of Central Florida. We have everything from photographic shops to big truck truck garages and the likes of that. The whole gamut. We make parts for everybody. And all of them now have started slowing down. Because I'm interested enough to ask them, well, Bill, how's it going? Is it your business slow? Yeah, we're off about 10%. We're up 15%. And it's this way across the board. There's only one person that's got a business in Central Florida that's got more business than he can handle. And that's the auctioneers. Now, Don Dennett in Sanford, Dennett Auctioneering, has been a friend of mine since he was in high school. And Don is running a very good business today. We went to a sale last week over here in Castleberry. FutureCon, multi-million-dollar company, a beautiful shop, bankrupt. Up for sale and went on an auction block. I said to Don at the sale, I said, Don, why in the world would something like this happen? He said, there's no volume of work. He happened to have an Air Force contract that kept him going for the last 2 or 3 years. When that contract ended, he was done. Because he had so much invested in big equipment, nothing to do. He had to sell out. Don says, I could have a sale, an auction a day if I wanted to. There's that many people out here going bankrupt. But he only has one a week. Because the market will only handle so much. Otherwise, you'd have people there buying shares for a dime and the likes of it. He waits until the smoke clears, then he'll have another auction.
Okay.
But he is busy all the time, believe me. Right now, he's ready for two more auctions. I talked to him yesterday. He got two more shots that went out, and he's a bunch of restaurant equipment again. A couple more restaurants went broke, and he's going to sell him the auction. But he has got more work, and he knows what to do with. But that's because that's people's downfall that he's taking advantage of.
This is not a problem you're having, though, sir.
No, we're sitting tight. We're solvent. We don't owe a dime to anybody. We have one thing. We buy steel on a 30-day basis. We buy sheet, plate, angle, and beam, and bar from three different companies. We pay our bill at the end of the month, every month, religiously. Every 30 days, we pay our invoices up, and they're done. We run no credit with nobody. We pay cash for everything.
Okay, sir. The proper way to run a business, right?
And 90% of the people, I'd say 95% of the people that we work for appreciate that fact because their paperwork don't carry over from month to month to month to month. When they deal with us and they come out, if we don't have a prior agreement of 30 days on invoice, they pay cash and bring a check with them because that's the only way we'll work. We won't chase any money. You can't spend your time chasing bad debts. And over the last 40 years, I don't think we've lost $100. And that's because somebody died and there was no heirs. That's the only reason.
Gotcha, sir. Well, I know you said that they ruined Central Florida.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
Would you say there is anything good in Central Florida? Anything that...
Well,
I know you discussed what had gone wrong. Would anything in your mind have gone right?
What Florida did, by them having all of their eggs in one basket with tourism, they've helped other industries and other things grow with them. The motel industry grew, the restaurants and the stores, that retailers and one thing another, a lot of those people now have picked up to the where that they rely on all of these people that's coming in. But when people come out of the airport and they go to Disney World, they're more or less captive at Disney World. Now, most of them are here for, say, 2 days, 3 days, a week, something like this. Their money is limited to what they can do. And when they have to spend $75 to go through that gate, they're going to think twice about having to go outside to buy something. Disney's smart enough to know this. That's why they got them captive. Restaurants, hotels, motels, the whole nine yards. Get them in the gate and keep them. But there's still a few people that want to see Central Florida. They want to get out and look around. We haven't come out here. But that Central Florida, in that respect, has grown along with all of the tourists. And it's helped the people that did stay here by giving them more of an opportunity to do things. Bowling alleys, your arts, and a lot of your museums have grown. Your arts and science have grown. Everything has helped the local people. And I consider myself to be part of the local people. But they have given us a top opportunity of more things which weren't here.
Okay, sir.
So you can give them the benefit of the doubt. Their finances and their establishment created an environment that people wanted. So it kind of rubs off on us local people. We're able to go take advantage of it too.
Okay, sir. I was going to say that was a very interesting perspective, because I know you never go to those parks, you never do any of those things.
No.
But the benefit, like the side benefits they bring with them.
Right.
Gotcha.
Right.
I know before you mentioned you had served in the military. Could you tell us about that, sir? Like
military?
What branch, where, when, what were you doing?
Well, I was in the military. I went in the military prior when the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
And I was in Fort Knox in the regular army before the Japanese hit Honolulu and Oahu. Now, when I went into Fort Thomas, Kentucky, I went from there to Fort Knox. When I was in Fort Thomas, Kentucky, there wasn't enough of us in that barracks to keep the fire going at night. We had to take shifts to keep the fire going at night. They declared war. The next day, they were standing in the hallways. They had helped so many people poured into that place. There was a mobilization overnight, believe me. Well, when I enlisted in the service, I was never drafted. I enlisted in the Air Force. There was no openings. So I left Fort Thomas, Kentucky, and went to Atlantic City, New Jersey for basic training. Well, when we got out there, of course, in wartime conditions, everything blackout at night and the whole story. Everything was all window curtains and the likes of it, no headlights and everything. Well, I left there and went out to Chanute Field, Illinois, and joined the Air Force. They had an opening, so I got transferred from the 3rd Army into the Air Force, which I had enlisted for to begin with. I wanted to get in the Air Force. So we went out there to Chanute Field and went through tech school. Graduated from tech school and got assigned to a regular Air Force unit. I was with them for quite a while, and then, well, we stationed in California and stationed in Texas and stationed in New Mexico and quite a few places. And then as the war progressed, they took our unit and broke it up into 4 units and made air combat cargo units out of them. So what we'd done was to airdrop supplies, ammunition, and equipment to the troops that were on the ground. That was our main, we were a transfer, I might say our airborne trucking outfit. But on our mission, whenever we took what we had there, if there was another outstanding hospital in the area, we went to that base and hauled a load of wounded back, litter patients we used to call them. So we'd take a load of supplies over wherever we were going and bring a load of litter patients back to the next general hospital. And that was our total obligation. And I did that in China, Burma, and India. Now, when the war ended, we were flying into Chungking when the war ended from Michinaw, North Burma. That was our last big U.S. air base in that part of the world. And when I say big air base, it was a grass, dirt strip of landing mats. But that was still, from that part of the world, that was a big air base. We flew C-47s, C-46s, and C-54s. And when the Japs were, we had moved out of Michinaw and went down to Bamo, Burma, right at the war's end. And we were flying then into Saigon. And when the war ended, then the way our orders were written, that at the war's end, we will be our organization equipment will be disbanded by the most expeditious means. And our colonel, who was Colonel Scannell, was a 36-year-old West Point man and a full command pilot. Now, that's a hard nut to crack. That's as good as you can get in the Air Force. We were all sitting down in what they called the bomb crater. We had a movie at night. Just a big bombed-out hole in the ground. We was all sitting around. They suddenly flashed the lights on the camera, and he says, "Boys, it's all over." And it took about a minute for it to sink in the fact that the war was over. And it was. And then 2 days later, we pulled out of there, loaded our planes, and we went back down into Tezgan, India. But when we left, all the tents, all the equipment, the toolboxes, everything that was left on that strip was either given to the hill tribes or was destroyed in the fire. We closed the base out. And that's the way we left. Now, one story that vividly sticks in my mind was that Michigan. It's M-Y-I-T-K-I-Y-N-A. Michigan, North Burma. Before the war, it was a big town. Well, the Japanese, in order to go on their route from Japan through China into India, that's what their object was. They'd already just about taken over China, and they were into India pretty deep. Well, our object was to see that they didn't get any further. We were kind of the stopgap in the middle. Mars Task Force and Merle's Marauders were the ground troops, and we get everything they ate, fed, shot, and whatever we supplied them, airdrop, whatever, to get to them. Well, one day, on the south end of our strip, was two fighter groups that supported us as air cover while we were flying and dropping supplies, the 82nd and 93rd Fighter Group. There was P-51s and P-47s. Now, most of these fighter planes, they were bombing down at the in the Mekong Delta, and they were down around the bridge over the River Kwai. That was one of their last bombing missions. Well, the line chief and I were standing alongside the strip, and we was watching it. They'd take off in about five, six, seven planes at a time. They'd fly together as a group. Low-altitude bombing on these targets, like roads and bridges and commercial buildings that was of value to Japanese. So Master Sergeant Hickey and I were standing there. It was a hot, typical hot day, and we was watching these P-47 take off, one right after the other. Well, when a fighter plane's carrying a 1,000-pound bomb under the belly of it, they got a load. Well, they would start at their end of the strip, and they'd tell them they were full throttle. And by the time they got halfway up the strip, they just about off the ground. And at the end of the strip was rice paddies and jungle. Well, we watched these planes, one, two, three, and the third one coming down the line, and all of a sudden he went straight up in the air. And the line chief said to me, he said, "Well, look at that damn fool." And I said, "Yeah, but look at there." And a 1,000-pound bomb had let go of the bottom of that plane. And here he was coming down the middle of the strip, tail first. 1,000-pounder. So Hinkie looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, "We better duck." And we went under the first thing that was there, and it was a big truck, and we went under it. Well, that bomb went right at the end of the strip, went right out in the rice paddy, and just settled down as nice as you please, and didn't explode. It went poosh right in the mud. We crawled out from the truck, and Hinkie said to me, he said, "Damn, that was close." And I says, "Too close." And I said, "Yeah, but look where we were." And we were underneath a tanker full of 100-octane gasoline. Oh, boy, that was a nice experience to have. But that was just one of the little things that happened throughout the war.
When did you, what age were you when you signed up, sir?
My 21st birthday, I was in combat.
Okay. When did you, but you said you signed, you enlisted prior to World War II,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, I was 18.
Oh, okay. And did you... enlist right after high school?
Yeah.
Okay, sir. And,
matter of fact, I went to trade school. That's how I got my start. I was going to trade school. And we had just finished. The way our school worked, it was called Dayton Cooperative High School. Mm-hmm. They had, well, all the instructors were professional people. They were profession in their trade. Well, the shops is what I was in, basically. And, of course, all of the instructors were master toolmakers. Well, when the war started, my class was just about ready. We went to school 2 weeks and worked 2 weeks. That's the way co-op was set up. You had to carry an 80 average to go to school. If you didn't maintain your class grades as well as your shop grades, you got pulled out. You had to go to a regular school. You couldn't no longer become a craftsman. You had to be interested and have a know-how of what you wanted to do. You had to want to know what you were doing. Well, at that time, that was in, I think we graduated December that year, and I went into service in September, just prior to that. And I'd say 90% of our class, males in our class, all went in about the same time. The whole class of 41 just about all went in the military at the same time. And I don't think, of course, we lost track of all of them, but I don't think after graduation, it wasn't more than a handful that even graduated after that because they'd all went in service.
Was that very normal at the time, sir?
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
The patriotism was extremely high. They had Japanese had submarines out off the East Coast. They had submarines off the West Coast. They were at our back door.
Hmm. Okay, sir, and you said you served for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And was that when the war was over?
Yeah.
And you came...
I was in the 1348th Air Combat Air Drop Unit. And when that... Our orders were cut in North Africa before we left Algiers, when we were sent into the CBI Theater, the general that wrote our orders for our outfit said that you will be there for the duration plus 6 months. Now, that's just like a life sentence. How long will it last? You got to be there in 6 months more. But luckily, when it ended, we was gone out of there off of our forward base in 2 days, 3 days at the most. We went what they call down the valley into India. Then we stayed there to be disoriented, is what they called it, to be re-civilianized. We had to turn in our guns and all of our grenades and all of our fighting equipment and try to be civilians. Well, it took longer than that to do. But anyway, we stayed there, I'd say for a period, we was at Tezgan, India, about a month. And then we got under General Stuart and came home. We came home first class on a big generalship, which was a well relief. We could have hot meals. You had a bed to sleep on. I mean, you wouldn't sleep on the ground. I mean, we're civilians now. Yeah, this is really living. Well, anyway, we got back into Camp Atterbury, Indiana, which was a discharge center. And the man in charge of the center, our whole outfit was there. We had 1,380 men and officers with our whole complete unit. All of our pilots were drafted civil pilots. Delta, Eastern, all of them were commercial pilots. They hated the military. Between them and us, the ground people, we got along fine because we didn't like it either. We got along great. Well, anyway, when we got into Camp Atterbury, we got all the shots and all the rest of the stuff, and turned everything in, got all the paperwork done. The commanding officer of that base had our commander, General Scanlon, or Colonel Scanlon, get up, and he said, Colonel, he said, we want to offer you people, your outfit, 1,380 men, all an increase in rank, one rank, with a one-year contract. The colonel said, I would like to speak for our men in behalf of them. He said, we've had 1,500 hours, most of us, of combat flying. He said, we want to go home and stay there. It's your baby. We quit. And that's the way it ended. There wasn't one man reenlisted. We had it.
You had your fill?
We had it. There was no part of it. But I'll tell you, still today, there's things at night flash through my mind, what we had done and what we did.
Thank you for your service.
It sticks in your mind. At that time, and the way the elements and the way everything was, you don't forget things like that. No, I don't care how old you get. You will not forget them. You try to. But there's things that always come back, like things that got blew up and things that got burned out and stuff. You don't forget it. I don't care what you do. I'd be down running a lathe, and sometimes, you remember that time with so-and-so like that, we changed an engine, and we used to call him Tokyo Joe. There was a zero. He used to come over about 2 o'clock every afternoon, and he'd drop what they call cluster bombs, small little ones, just enough to worry you. But one of them hit your tent, boy, you got a mess. It'd blow everything up. Tokyo Joe would come by every afternoon at 2 o'clock, and he'd drop over through cluster bombs, back over the mountains he'd go. Well, finally one day, we had a P-38 group that was going into Saigon, and this one pilot, he said, well, you know, he said, I'm going to get that SB. He said, I can fly higher than he can. So here come old Tokyo Joe over one afternoon right after chow. As we seen this old boy fire this P-38 up, and he went right straight up in the air, and Tokyo Joe knew something was happening. He turned tail and started to run. And before he got over the base of the Chinwin Hills, he blew him out of the sky. That was the end of the Jap. That was the last time we had him.
No more Tokyo Joe?
No more Tokyo Joe.
What would you do with your afternoons after that then, sir?
Oh, we worked. We worked round the clock. We had them. Our planes flew 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
Okay, sir. How long after you got back before you moved to Florida? How long did that take? Did you have to shovel snow for a winter?
No, I wasn't too long, a couple of years.
Okay, so.
Yeah. Well, I was just feeling things out to try to become a civilian again and decide which way I wanted to go. I knew I wanted to be in the metal work, but I didn't know how I wanted to approach it. I didn't know exactly how I wanted to do it, how I wanted to really get things started. And then as we got married and we had a couple of kids, one thing and another started, I said, well, I got to get my own business going. That's all there is to it. I can't work for somebody else because he's not only going to take the cream of the crop and I'm going to do all the dirty work. I want to be in a position where I can do the dirty work, take the cream of the crop, and try to establish some new business, try to build a new product, try to do things.
Makes sense, sir.
Without being a number in somebody's shop. So that was the way it started. That's the way Red Coat came about.
Okay, sir. Can you tell me about your family?
Yeah.
Like, who they are, how old, what year they were born.
Okay, well, we got married in 1946. And Larry is the oldest one. He come along a year later. Then Ronnie was the next son born about a year or two later. Then the twins came along about 2 years later.
Two boys,
Aaron,
two girls?
Sharon.
Oh, two.
And then Rusty came along about a year after that, and then that was the end of our family. We had five children.
And what's your wife's name, sir?
Mary Ann.
Okay. And what are your children doing now?
Well, the oldest one, Larry, is up in De Leon Springs. He's got a rat farm. He raises rats commercially. These people that have reptiles and all kinds of weird people, he's got a steady stream. He has quite an operation going. Many buildings full of these rats. And he sells them all over the world. Now, there's that many kooks out there, but he's got a real good business going.
Okay, so.
Now, the other son, Ronnie, he's got a drywall business. He does drywall work and painting. The girls, Sharon, my one daughter, is a school teacher over in Sanford. Karen is an expediter for FedEx downtown. And Rusty works full-time in the shop for me.
Okay, sir. And do you have a... How did you meet your wife?
Well, that was a long story, too. We both worked at National Cash Register. When I first came in from the service, I went to work for National Cash Register. Because my dad had worked there all his life. Her dad had worked there all his life. So it was just a simple matter of walking in, getting a job, because that was where you, if you decided to work there, you had a lifetime job. They didn't hire people and fire them the next day. There was enough business in that company, it was self-sustaining. When they made National Cash Registers, they went all over the world, and there was boxcar loads of material coming in every day. It was its own entity. When you went to work there, you quit looking for a job, because if you couldn't make it in one department, they'd transfer you to another department. There was 38,000 people working in that building, in that factory. They could find something for you to do. They had a huge restaurant. So at noontime one day, the fellow I was kind of running with at the time, he was a Navy man. We got along real good. He would run the screw machine, so was I. So one day at noontime, I said, well, Friday they always had fish frying. Boy, it was good fish. So Friday, we'd go to Master over to mess hall and get and eat lunch. Well, while we were sitting there eating lunch, Annie and her girlfriend, she worked up in Building 4. It was some kind of an assembly job. Well, anyway, her and her girlfriend was down there eating, too. One of them had dropped a spoon on the floor. And I don't know whether Mike picked it up or I did, but one of us picked it up, and we handed it to him, and we got to talking, and that's how it started.
Okay, so something as small as a...
It was obscure can be. So I said to her, I said, yeah, I said, my name's Dick. She said, well, my name's Ann. And she said, I work over in Building 4. I said, well, we work in Building 27. And we got talking there for a few minutes, just at lunch period. And I said, well, I said, where do you live? She said, I live out off of Smithville Road out. And I said, well, I live out in Walnut Hills, both parts of East Dayton. And I said, well, what are you going to do Friday night? She said, I don't know. I said, well, you want to go bowling? She said, sure. I got her phone number, and that was it. We started going together. We got married, and she got laid off because the NCR, you couldn't have two people in the same family unless they were married. And once they got married, you couldn't hire them. Two people can't work there.
Okay.
She got married, she got laid off. Well, that's how it started. So we got married, she got laid off, and I went out, I bought a little piece of property, and I started building a house, and over a period of about 2 years, I got the house built. And we had all the children in, well, most of the children in, and one thing led to another, and we outgrew that, and we went out in the country, and I bought 5 acres and built a house out there, and when all the children were in school, that's when we came to Florida. Things got real bad up there in the early 50s. You couldn't buy a job. It got the same way here, except it was localized. And I went to Indiana, went to Kentucky, I went all over. There was no job. Nobody was hiring. So I said, okay. I said, we're not shoveling more snow. I said, we're loading up, we're leaving. So I hired a local trucker. I said, now I want you to move my shop. We took just the prime equipment out of there, just enough to know we could make a living. drills and saws, a couple of lathes, a milling machine, one thing or another. Everything else had a public sale. Sold the house, the farm, everything. We got in the truck and we moved. We come to Florida. Been here ever since.
Had a lot of reasons to come to Florida.
Yep. And like I say, when I went to work, trade tool and engraving, we've never been out of a job since. I went back to the motel in Titusville. I saw someone pack a sandwich and a couple apples or something. I said, I'm going to work tonight. She said, you know what? I said, I got a job over in Orlando. She said, you kidding me? And I said, no, here's the paper. And looked at it and she said, well, be damned. Been working ever since.
There you go, sir. Do you feel like there's anything we haven't just talked about that you'd like to talk about?
No, we're just about as plain as you can get. Everybody in this part of the world knows us and knows what we do. We've got a reputation for doing a good job, quick, at a fair price. I don't think we've had more than one or two disgruntled people that needed something done. And that was the fact that they were the type of people that nobody could satisfy. They have never come back, and I'm glad of it. Now, as you see, we have no advertisement whatsoever, yet we're busy all the time. That speaks for itself. We do good work, on time, at a good price. And people always come back.
The ones you want to come back.
And they will tell somebody else. I always give them a business card. I said, now, your neighbor wants something done. Here it is. That's the only advertisement we got.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir, for taking time out today.
I'll show you one of our cards here. Yeah, you got them right there.